I'm Stephen M. Hall, MD, an integral physician.
And I'm Grace Porter, a licensed psychotherapist. And together, we're the 7 Tools, a company focused on your personal growth and transformation.
And you are here with us for the Change for Good Summit. This year, we're focusing on building resilience in anxious times.
This summit is full of deep conversation and practical advice. We hope you enjoy this interview.
So now let's dive in.
Welcome back to the Change for Good, Building Resilience in Anxious Times Summit. I'm Grace Porter of the 7 Tools of Healing, and I am here today with Heidi Reed, who is a fiber artist, and we are going to be talking about creativity and community as resilience builders. Now, Heidi Reed has lived a patchwork quilt of a life, and this has allowed her to indulge varied interests as well as to develop a quirky skill set. She enjoys making things, particularly with other people, and she has spent decades working with the Boise Peace Quilt Project, waging peace from a quilting frame. This group has made over 50 quilts, which are awarded to peacemakers. They're tools for change of the social fabric, as well as experiments in working together. An Academy Award-nominated documentary, A Stitch for Time, was made about this group, so you may have seen them there. Reed also works for Dr. Patch Adams and the Gesundheit Institute as a costume therapist and administrative assistant. The work focused on creating a healing context for individuals, making joyful service healing for the healers, as well as integrating fun with hard work. And Reed continues to sew costumes and costume props for Dr. Adams. The Memory Sisters is an ongoing collaboration which grew out of volunteer work with the new old-time Chautauqua in the Pacific Northwest. Reed and her painting partner, Marsha Way Brady, hand paint and sell silk accessories and art clothing. Whenever possible, they like to offer others the opportunity to paint on silk because they find that it reawakens creativity and healing fun. And in the current manifestation of Reed's long-running social experiment, she serves as Nana to 4 grandchildren and mom to 2 kids and their spouses. Her daily partner is a large brown woofy noof, who I would like to add is quite the incredible dog. And since I know her dog, you may also notice that I probably also know her. And so for transparency's sake, I would like to say that Heidi has been a part of my greater family since before I was even born. Her family and my family became fast friends when they all lived in Boise before I was even born. My older sister was just a little one. And Heidi's artful creations have been treasures in my life and in my home and are often referred to as a Heidi Reed, as in, well, that's a Heidi Reed, as in that's a Monet or that's a Picasso. So her art is highly regarded in my life, to say the least. And her love of colors and cloth have brought so much joy and brightness to my life. And I am so happy to have this opportunity to be sharing her with you today. So from the bottom of my heart, Heidi, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Grace.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and in your work with the Memory Sisters? What does that entail? What does that look like?
Well, I'm one part of 2 women who call ourselves the Memory Sisters. And we got our name. We choose to be sisters. And we got our name when we were playing with the new old time Chautauqua and found ourselves cooking for 75 people and doing some of the more menial tasks related to cooking for 75 people and thinking about the glamour of our compatriots who were vaudevillians, performers, and we thought to entertain ourselves that we would have an act later. And because we were young and still had our memories, we thought that naming ourselves the Memory Sisters would be funny. And now, many decades later, we are still together and our name is more appropriate than it was at the beginning. And it seems to resonate with a lot of our customers. We started being the Memory Sisters after we dyed a lot of fabric for some of the peace quilts. And we wanted to figure out a way to keep dyeing fabric because it was really, really fun. And so we have been painting and selling wearable art, a lot of it painting on silk and some of it sewn and otherwise constructed. We sell online and we sell every week, rain or shine, and in frigid weather, at the local public market. So we get to meet our customers and do a lot of custom work and get to know people and understand, you know, what it is about wearing clothing that reflects their reality, that what it does for their lives. So,
No, that sounds really special. That the listeners won't be able to see me, but you should know that I am wearing a Memory Sister special that was custom made for me when I had my son, and it's a mother maiden crone, or I guess it's the pregnant, the baby, and then a woman. It's a really beautiful and colorful scarf, so it's a really special piece for me that marked an important moment in my life. So. So when I first knew you, in other words, when I was an infant and there, you were really deeply involved in the Boise Peace Project. And I was hoping that you could explain to listeners a little bit what that project was and what the project was trying to do. Like, what was it? What were you doing?
Sure. It began in the early 80s, and it was born in a room where a woman named Janet Gordon, a Nevada resident, was talking to an audience of local activists about the cancers that had afflicted her family as a result of the atomic testing done in her state. And it was deeply moving. And two women were sitting next to one another who did not know each other. And with tears in their eyes, one looked at the other and said, "Someone should do something about this." And woman number two said, "Why don't we?" And that was the beginning of the Boise Peace Quilt Project. Those are our founding mothers, Anne Hausrath and Diane Jones. And the idea that came to them after they gave themselves a little time to try to figure out what to do was brilliant and improbable. They decided to make a friendship quilt for ordinary citizens in the Soviet Union, because our country and the people that we knew and we were engulfed in a fearsome Cold War that looked like the only end to it would be mutual annihilation. And so, of course, we decided to make a quilt, and people just instantly wanted to participate. 35 people, we needed 35 quilt squares, and 35 folks who did not know each other, not all women, but mostly, some children. It really hit a nerve, and people stitched whether they had ever stitched before. Quite a variety of squares that represented the things that they couldn't bear to think of losing, you know, and the things that they had in common with ordinary citizens in the Soviet Union. A quilt was made, and quilters were brought in to help people learn how to quilt because they didn't really know how.
New skills.
Friendships, including mine with your mom, were formed over that first quilting frame, and we met in people's living rooms and basements and backyards and wherever we could, and quilted with tiny little hand stitches all of our anxieties and fears and love into that document. And then you can't, if you make something that heartfelt, you can't just put it in a box and send it away. So there were four women who committed to going to Washington, D.C. and going to the Soviet embassy and hand delivering the quilt to a human being. That was the closest we could get to giving it to ordinary people. And we held a bake sale in order to send them, at which we made $32, I recall. It was totally improbable. And it changed all the people who worked on it. So when that quilt was, and I should say the quilt ended up in Lithuania in a museum. And I hope a lot of ordinary people saw it. You know,
I'm sure they did.
When that quilt was over, the two founding mothers and a lot of the initiators, who they put everything in their lives on hold to finish that quilt. It felt so compelling to do something quickly that by the time the quilt was done, the last stitch taken, and the women seen off on the airplane, most of those people were wiping their brows and going, well, that was something, you know, and returning to their lives and their families and their jobs. And I happened to be one of the small group of people who were saying, what? We're quitting? We can't quit. This has to keep going, you know. There's so much potential here. Yeah. And to be fair, I had a long already developed identity as a fiber artist, and it seemed like exactly how I ought to be making my presence known. So I, encouraged people and solicited people and talked people into joining me on quilt number two. And we decided to make quilts. We could already foresee that these were going to be the Nobels of the quilting world. Mm-hmm. And we made a huge, gigantic quilt, which featured squares of families, all different kinds of families, from dinosaur families to, you know, in my case, it was the drawings my kids made of their family. Families skiing or, you know, very ordinary. But at the same time, we asked everybody we knew to nominate peacemakers to be recipients, thinking that we could help people flesh out in their minds what kind of skills were included in creating the world we wanted to live in and we wanted for our children. We got hundreds of suggestions. And when we took the quilt around trying to make it really public, the process, and we quilted in public schools and in churches and in parks and, you know, everywhere we could. And we hand embroidered the full names of every one of the people who was nominated to receive that quilt onto the quilt, which this might be a rabbit hole, I'm not sure. If we thought about it a little bit more carefully, we might not have done that, because we had a lot of time and effort then by the time the quilt was done, and all those little red names were in the braided quilted pattern around the border. Everybody had invested their care and their passion, and they all, you know, knew their favorites about who should get this. This quilt of our
So how did you make a decision?
That has been a peak experience in my life, that decision-making process. Might have happened at your mom's basement. Did you have a basement?
I don't know. I actually never lived there.
I think it was at your mom's house, and we committed to meeting and deciding and not leaving the meeting until we had decided what we were going to do with it. And we had some not very well informed ideas about consensual decision making and about not voting, definitely not voting so that there wouldn't be losers, you know, but just laboring. And we did not really have developed skills for the process, but we knew where we wanted to get at the end, where everyone felt good about a common goal, because there's only one quilt. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
you don't want to cut it up and send a quarter. Ooh,
yeah. So it was a long, long process, and people kept advocating for their favorites with passion, and there were tears and there was laughter, and people would advocate again, and then eventually they allowed themselves to be moved by one another. And you know, one person who'd been advocating for this nominee would say, "I can see how important yours is. I'm going to stand aside, and or let me join you in advocating for that person." And by the end of the night, it was a really long night. We had decided. We had decided who to give it to, and we all agreed. And I remember driving home, just thinking, "This is miraculous. And if this can happen, anything can happen." So that's how we decided. And it was given to Norman Cousins, who was the editor of the Saturday Review of Literature for many years, a diplomat, an activist, a brilliant man who was also very unassuming. And as an aside, I found myself in a position where I had to call and talk to him about the quilt. And at that time, as a fully grown adult with two children, I was unable and unwilling to make long distance phone calls. So here we are. We've come along. I was too freaked out by the import of committing myself, you know, on the phone. Expressing myself in that way. But the Quilt Project led a lot of us
into new places.
To our new selves, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Quilt Project is still meeting. We're doing it in a kind of a grandmotherly way, much slower. We meet every 2 weeks. We've been working for some time on a quilt to welcome refugees to our community. Mm. We have, in the meantime, in the intervening decades, made probably 50 quilts for peacemakers who are, some few of them are politicians, some are educators, some are healthcare professionals, some are artists, some are performers. The peacemaking has been broadly defined, and yeah. We have sometimes made quilts.
As is the work, right?
Right. Right. Sometimes we just do a quilt in order to do an experiment in working together with people we thought we couldn't work with, or that we weren't sure how to do, you know. Sometimes we've made quilts that we feel will make a statement about how we feel things ought to be. So that's the story of the Quilt Project.
So it really sounds like a medium both for creating community and creating a space for creativity and like growing and healing interrelational pieces, and also bringing space for some of the maybe harder to talk about or the pieces that maybe don't have a lot of other constructive space.
And very sneaky too, because almost everybody wants to talk about quilts. And we didn't really plan that way, but it turns
easy
out
approach.
We can talk to pretty much anybody, you know, about the quilts in their family. Or,
So my curious mind wants to know if after that second quilt, if the recipients were decided before the quilt were made, or if this decision-making process continued into perpetuity.
Well, we kept the part that really served us well, which was making decisions by consensus. Mm. And we got a lot better at it. And it became kind of a something that we really looked forward to, the process. But we did shift to inviting individuals to make nominations, and then one quilter or several quilters would present that idea with an interest in spearheading the effort. And so we decided together, but we decided before we actually made the quilt.
Before the hours.
We have to do that more.
Blood, sweat, and tears. Once
we'll figure that out.
Yeah. So you've talked a little bit about this in your answer, but I'm hoping that we can just pull the threads a little bit. See what I did there. to address like how creativity is working in your life and what the act of being creative does, or allowing space for creativity in your day-to-day life, what that does for you.
I'm not sure how I would live without it, really. And I would like to advocate for people understanding themselves to be creative. I have met so many people who say, "Oh, you're so creative. I wish I was creative." And it's my uneducated observation that everyone is creative. Some people have been shamed out of particular forms of creativity, like singing in public, maybe, or painting, oil painting, or I don't know. But there is an outlet for creative expression for everyone, and I think we're here to give whatever we have to offer. And yeah, so I can't imagine living without it. It makes me hopeful, sometimes frustrated, most often excited. It's kind of the kind of creativity that I'm engaged in right now. Often say it's painting on silk. It's very unpredictable. Mm. And so there's anticipation.
A measure of letting go of
shock
outcome.
And horror. Oh, yes. And then sometimes just delight at how things work out. I mean, you have alluded to the element of working together with other people in the creative process, and that has given me so much. The relationships, the shared history, the larger quilting family that I identify with, and I guess I shouldn't just say quilters, but maybe activist family, that they feel like my family. So,
yeah. So, and because this is a summit, plus it's fun. So we are a greater topic of this summit. We are talking about anxiety. And so I'm wanting to bring that piece into our conversation before we get much further into it, and ask you like how creativity has interacted with anxiety for you. You talked about this a little bit in relation to the long distance phone call perhaps, but like what role creativity and perhaps community have for you in your own experience of anxiety, and how you maybe have seen that the people in your quilting community or your creative community at large, how you've seen the interplay between anxiety and creativity. And I'm leaving this kind of intentionally vague, so I'm hoping you know where I'm.
I can say that when I started quilting, my kids were young, and I was really feeling heavily my parental responsibility to, at the very least, help them grow to maturity physically, you know. And I got myself into quite a desperate, anxious situation where every time I heard a jet taking off, I could envision Armageddon, you know. It was very present to me. Yeah, so at some point I decided that if I'd make a deal with myself, you know, a survivable deal. If I worked a certain amount at addressing that which was making me anxious, then I would leave off fretting about it at all times. Mm. And that, I don't know whether my friends did the same thing or not. I know that they were they were affected by taking action. And for me, having it be a creative response was, it was natural to me, and it had a lot of bonuses. And that worked for a long time. I did have to keep recalibrating every so often, like, oh, I see, I think I'm doing a little more than I should be doing here, because my equanimity is suffering in other areas. But, or I think I'm getting a little lax, I need to do a little more, try a little harder. So that's how I've managed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that idea of making a deal with yourself, because a lot of these things that we worry about are things that are, we may have some semblance of influence over, but by and large, they're things that are outside of our control, or the part that we have to play in it is a very small piece in a very large, I was going to say puzzle, but we'll go with quilt, that we can do our own part, but we can't do all of it. And so
right.
Making that deal with yourself kind of feels like it lets yourself off the hook for the entirety of it, and just brings your sense of responsibility back to the part that's actually yours, which is the part that you have control over, the part that you have, because no one of us can do everything.
Right.
Yeah. Hmm. And yet it feels like I'm just kind of keep thinking about this quilt hanging in a museum in Lithuania, and what it's like for me as a museum goer to walk by something like that and engage with it, and to recognize the hours and the love and the, it's making me tear up a little bit just talking about it, that it's very, the impact is very present. It's very tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it, parts of my brain go, oh, it's a quilt and it's, world peace, and what do the two things have to do with each other? But they really do, because the peace comes from those internal moments that we have as humans. And that's really what you're building through your creative expression.
I think I should tell you about our ninth quilt, which we made in the mid-80s. And it was called the National Peace Quilt. And it had a square from every one of the 50 states.
Mm.
And those squares were children's visions of peace and security. And it was all red, white. It is all red, white, and blue. And it is enormous. And one of the dimensions is 8 feet. I mean, it's this huge quilt. And, in each corner it says things like, speak truth to power, and the main inscription says, rest beneath the warmth and weight of our hopes for the future of our children, dream a vision of the world at peace, and act to give the vision life. And we not only made the quilt, but then we thought we were going to have all of the United States senators spend a night sleeping under it so that they would kind of get in a personal way, like you were describing, entering into the extent of what the artifact represents.
Mm-hmm.
People thought we were crazy. And we're just people working in our basements, calling people, anybody we know, and is there anybody in West Virginia that could... And by the end, 67 of the 100 senators spent a night sleeping under the quilt.
Oh, wow.
And so there was, there's the homely appeal of the quilt, and there's also the fact that these other people slept under it, and Life magazine calls and says, we'd like to take a picture of the quilt with 6 senators under it. And we said, we were just horrified. No, this is serious. it's not something to be made fun of. I don't know whether we would say that now, but the senators wrote after their sleeping experience about what it was like, what the experience was. And some of them were very touching. Definitely worth it.
Where is that one now?
We still have it and display it. The Smithsonian's Political History Division said at one point that they would like to have it for their collection. So perhaps it will end up there. I'm not sure.
Mm.
It's been in a lot of parades on the 4th of July.
I believe it. It's a powerful piece. Yeah. And again, this is something that I feel like the threads are all there, and I'm just really wanting to make sure that we're pulling them out enough to be kind of consciously looking at them. And so the next little piece that I was hoping we could talk to specifically is this idea of like building positivity or building building resilience, building connection. And maybe all of those things are different and maybe they're not so different. But doing that through the use of creativity or through creative means, and what your experience of that is, and what you see as the power of that.
For me, any resilience gained has, with quilts, with the Gesundheit Institute, other projects I've worked on, it's about the personal outlet for creativity and about the community that has formed around it. All of those things have made me more hopeful about, I mean, for a long time I wore a shirt called Hopeless Optimist because it was true, and with really no, when you look around, you might think that there are no good reasons for being optimistic, but the ability to form alliances and lasting community through shared creative effort, it is hopeful. It is optimistic. I mean, I feel like the wilderness at the edge of our civilization, where we are, where what we do is going to make or break us, it's all about being able to work together. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not.
Yeah, I think so. Or perhaps you're answering the other question that was floating around that I asked the other one of instead. But is that the process of working together on something versus like a solo creative project, like what the added component of having it be a community effort as opposed to it being a solitary effort?
Being exercising your creative muscle. Mm-hmm. I understand resilience to be the ability to spring back after something difficult, to survive and persist, something that seems devastating. Personal creativity without anyone else involved can really have an impact on your resilience, I think. It gives you the feeling that you are able to do something under your own control.
Mm-hmm.
When your creative effort leads to a positive outcome, it can be very satisfying and give you a sense of power and autonomy that allows you to spring back after difficult things.
Yeah, it almost kind of feels like you're birthing something or you're bringing something into this world, and that life energy might feel kind of invigorating and fortifying.
Yeah, I found it to be so.
Let's kind of shift back to the work of the Boise Peace Project, because I think that it's a really beautiful example of what we're talking about, and I feel like what we're talking about is a little bit feels a little bit nebulous, and so it feels nice to have
something concrete
to bring the examples into so that it comes alive a little bit for us. You touched on this again, but that feeling of being able to do something in the face of the fears, or being more resilient to the fears. And you spoke about your own experience, but I'm wondering if you can, like, as a group, talk about the energy that was built for, you know, quieting the anxiety of the time through that joint endeavor. Because the topics of the quilts have changed over the course of time, right? Like, they haven't all been about nuclear annihilation. There's about what was happening in Central America and all kinds of things over the last number of decades. So I'm imagining that the fears that people had or like what was alive within the group was changing as the times changed. Yeah, I guess what I'm really asking is like how the project as a whole or the kind of the momentum and the group cohesion of the project allowed space for people's fears and then like what it was about that space that allowed some wanting to use pacification, but I'm not even sure that's the right word, of those fears to allow them to be more tolerable, to allow you all to continue to work without and live and raise your children and all of the other things that you did without feeling immobilized or overwhelmed by the anxieties of the time.
I can mostly speak for myself.
Yeah.
And for what I perceive to be the general group feeling. I think once we got started and it became clear that there was going to be a second quilt and a third quilt and a fourth quilt.
And a 43rd.
We weren't going to quit. You know, for me, the fears and the high level of daily anxiety went away. And sometimes I would see in people joining us or drawn to a particular project that they had strong feelings about, I could see a transformative process where once you begin doing something with your hands and your other tools that addresses that which you fear or are anxious about, you have an effect on your experience of the fear or the anxiety. I mean, for me, fear and anxiety was a feature of the beginning of this process, and staying active kept all of those things out of my life, really. It wasn't something that, oh, there's a fresh crisis in Central America. Now I'm anxious about that. What will I do? It was kind of a sense that we had some tools, unlikely as they were, to do something about whatever. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to do it alone. We would be together.
Mm.
One of the long-standing things that I'm very grateful to the Quilt Project and that experience for is that a lot of the contemporaries of my children have struggled mightily through their 20s and maybe even longer, trying to come to grips with the world around them. I think partly because of the Quilt Project and our family engagement in it, both of my kids figured out something to do. They knew that something could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And my son, when he was 5 and he would hear about some injustice or some terrible thing, you know, he would just say, someone should do something about that. Let's fix that, you know. And he has not lost his dedication to that process.
No, you know, he hasn't.
Things. Same with my daughter.
Yeah, and they chose very different routes.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
But both in service to the greater good.
Yeah.
So I think it is infectious, this process. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you have to necessarily keep doing over and over again. Yeah. It's a balancing act. And it can infect other people without your intention.
Yeah. And that idea of finding the route that works best for you. Right, that for you, quilting was the medium where this work happened, and that these ideas can be. We're by no means saying everybody go out and start your own quilting group.
Right? I would not recommend it.
But there is something.
Nor knitting,
crochet, cross stitch.
I don't think so.
But finding the medium where you come alive, finding the medium where your skill sets are. Either you can learn it or your skill sets that you already have are applicable but allowing there to be space for these ideas of creativity and community and recognizing their value, recognizing all of the effects that they have, even though they're not necessarily front and foremost in what we think about when we think about creativity. Mm-hmm. But it nonetheless is still what's happening when we engage in creativity. Mm-hmm. You're in creative endeavors. Yeah. It just feels really spacious, I guess. Feels like it kind of pushes the anxiety back a little bit, enough to breathe, enough to live. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that one of the things that can be so difficult about anxiety is that it can feel sort of immobilizing. We get into these cycles with it where we don't really know the way out, and we don't, like, the path forward isn't necessarily very clear. And sometimes, like you're saying, it is the most unexpected roads that end up being the most fruitful, I guess, is the word that's coming to mind, that you know, it's this idea of someone should do something about that. Why don't we? What do we know how to do? We know how to quilt. Let's quilt.
No, we didn't even know how to quilt.
We didn't know how to quilt. Let's learn how to quilt. So then where did the idea for a quilt come from if nobody knew how to quilt?
Well, the friendship quilt is a very old American folk art form. Mm-hmm. It's a tradition that we have to offer, even if we don't know how to do it yet.
So it felt like something of you, not necessarily personally, but of something American,
our culture.
Something of the, like, the beauty of our culture. Mm-hmm. That you could share with them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of finding the beauty in moments.
I'm for some reason flashing on this experience you were talking about, the anxiety, and I wanted to say, I didn't mean to give the impression that the anxiety was over the minute I started to work on a second quilt.
I was going to say, may we all start our second quilt.
Yeah. The moment that I'm flashing on is the quilt project is sending me with pieces of a quilt that we are making together with the Soviet Women's Committee, which is like us deciding to make a quilt with the federal government. You know, it's like, it's sort of also very improbable. So they're sending me with the parts that we have made, which are beautiful, I have to say, portraits of both our children and of Soviet children. Mm. And they're sending me to England to meet emissaries of the Soviet Women's Committee, bearing their part of the quilt. And by the way, there is a documentary film crew, six or eight people, you know, all around the whole thing. And there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen. And am I going to remember my name? You know, it's just, I was so anxious about getting on that plane. And this is in the days where there wasn't security. And people would go to the door of the where you walk down the jetway to get on the airplane, you know, to see you off or to welcome you back. And I am stressed. I'm stressed. Do I have everything packed? Do I have the pieces? What's going to be happening in my absence? Who's taking care of the children? You know, And we get to the little waiting area by my gate. And there are all the quilters, and they are all wearing aprons. Some of them freshly used and holding flowers, you know, and Anne presses this little envelope in my hand, and I take it onto the plane and read it after the doors are closed. And it says, remember, we're all just mothers who want our children to grow up. Mm. You know, you don't have to be anything except yourself, and do your best.
You are enough.
So, aside from you are enough, you are not alone. Mm. And that was particularly powerful for me. And I think that kind of thing has happened over and over and over again.
Mm. Yeah. So less of a cure for anxiety and more of a building of resilience in the face of anxieties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is really mostly the goal anyway.
Okay.
Because things will happen. The world is full of things that happen all the time. And what we have control over is our response to it. Yeah. Yes, that community showing up in your moment of need.
Well, I have to say there was another time where they're sending me to New York City to a quilt festival to be on a panel. Also somewhat anxious. The person who didn't talk on the telephone is going to get up in front of a bunch of people, talk with some of her heroines in the quilting world, you know. And we get to the top of the escalator at the airport. We're leaving on the 6 a.m. flight time. Hmm. My family is there, barely awake, holding my hand, taking me to the gate. We crest the second floor and see this line of feet, slippers. And we come up, and here are about 12 women and men in their pajamas and their bathrobes doing the can-can. I love them for it. It's like, you can do that, I can do this. Which reminds me to mention, if I haven't already, you better make sure that it's fun, or you won't be able to last.
Yeah, I was going to say, this feels like the intersection of Gesundheit and the Boise Peace Quilt Project.
That's right.
Laughter. Yeah. Yeah, so I know that the Memory Sisters are making scarves. Are making scarves, as though you are not one of them, that you and Marcia are making scarves as the Memory Sister, that are really helping people transition in between phases in their lives or celebrating things that are alive in their lives. You know, for example, the scarf that I'm wearing now that was a celebration of me becoming a mother. Or you know, you make those goddess scarves, and regardless of whether or not you want to buy any of her scarves, which you should because they are amazing, but you should definitely go check out her website because the work is just really beautiful. You make these really beautiful goddess scarves that are like aimed at helping women love their bodies. They're just these very vivacious women in all of these extraordinary colors and color combinations, and they're just so alive. And I am always struck that this is just such a beautiful way to help people, or a really beautiful way to be present with what it means to be in a body. And I think, you know, a lot of us have a lot of anxieties about the realities of living in a body and how that fits into society.
That's
and
so
family.
Nice.
So I guess I'm curious if you have any suggestions for the listeners about artistic ways to do this for themselves, or to kind of engage in this this love and celebration of the parts that feel tender or vulnerable, or the parts where maybe some of their anxiety shows up in their own selves or their own lives.
I will say that the secret scarves, or the goddess scarves, have been surprisingly powerful. And because they're made out of silk chiffon, they are a little bit transparent. So when you hold them up in front of your body, it's kind of like the viewer can see your inner self. And I think the thing that is powerful about them is it gives you an opportunity to align what your inside reality is with your outside presentation of it. Mm. And that is deeply relieving when you don't maintain two realities at the same time. It's really awesome. Possibly related, I remember I was wrestling with the question of vulnerability, and my perception that it is being vulnerable is probably the best protection, which I can't, it's just an intuition. I can't really represented any other way. So going to a Gesundheit Institute event was in Canada, I think, I made myself a costume that was called the Armor of Vulnerability. And so I had a shirt or top of some sort that on which I had written very legibly, big and dark, all the vulnerable things I could think of that I normally would not share with public at large or with people that I meet. And then I made, I found this awesome fabric that was transparent and had, it had big gold stars all over it. And so I made it a jacket that went over the shirt. So it was hidden, but not really. I mean, you could read, what? You know, like people sitting behind me were like, what? Mm-hmm. And it was, the experience of that was really empowering, you know, to not maintain a difference between who I was presenting to the world at large and who I really was.
Yeah, it feels like another space maker.
Uh-huh.
Part of us that tries so hard to hold back. Takes a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So I've now forgotten if there was a second part of that question. But
Well, we were talking about whether there were things that people could do for themselves to kind of help with that, the artistic expression of themselves and using that artistic expression to help in those places that feel vulnerable or painful or scared or anxious.
Well, I don't mean for all of my examples to be using stitching and textile arts. I would like to encourage people to understand creative expression as broadly as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be what you make for dinner.
Right.
It might be the weeding of your garden or whatever it is that puts your effect out into the world.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody has to find their own path to it. But it's that creative energy, the connection of community. I want to speak about myself a little bit for a second here, and that there is a kind of a loud, wild part of myself that as I've gotten older, I've curtailed much more. I was much more front and center when I was a child. And some of the things that you have given me over the years actually have most notably some rather wild, very colorful earrings that you made for me that kind of go in all different directions and have all kinds of colors, and there were bells on them and they would rattle. And and so the days when I would choose those earrings, which, well, it was your creative endeavor, I was engaging with that creativity through wearing them. The interactions that I would have with people or just how I would feel within myself, it felt like there was a lot more space for that, like, wild. Mm. I don't mean wild in a bad way. I just mean, like, uninhibited, kind of very alive and vibrant and mm-hmm. and less censored part mm-hmm. of myself to be. Yeah, so I guess I'm just thinking about that when we're able to find the means, whether it's through our own creation or through the inclusion of other people's creative output, it creates this space for ourselves to awaken those other parts of ourselves that maybe feel really supportive and loving. And overall, I think I feel much better when that part of myself has more space.
Oh, good.
Yeah, like that energy that goes to keeping her curtailed is freed up for other endeavors.
Yes, exactly.
I can be more productive in life when I don't try to censor myself.
Uh-huh. That's a good point.
Yeah, so I think sometimes it's about finding it, whether it's, you know, I didn't beat those, but the impact is still there in my life.
Yeah.
Good.
Glad to hear it.
So this kind of leads me to my last question for you, which is, if you could leave our listeners with three concrete tips for building resilience in anxious times, what would they be? And maybe especially, how to use creativity to build resilience in particular.
So I was going to suggest, first of all, that you try to be aware of at least one creative effort in a day. Mm. It will make you more aware of the life that you have and probably more grateful for it. It could make your life more fun, and it could be that pie crust that you make, or it could be writing in your journal or mending something or being silly with as a young person. But be aware of trying to do something every day, identify something that mm-hmm. is creative. I've already said this. Secondly, my personal belief is that together is better. It's like more evolved. It's harder and it has higher benefits. And so if you can find a way of being creative with someone else's engagement, you know, try that out.
See where the magic happens.
Yeah.
Or see where the magic happens.
Lastly, and I say this from the bottom of my heart, make sure that it is fun for you overall before you take anything big on. Mm-hmm. Or there are ways to make it fun. Ways to do or accomplish your goal that will keep you going.
Yeah, I really like the enlivening. Yeah, so if people are wanting to see some of the quilts that the Boise Peace Quilt have made, is there a place to see them in person or the images thereof, or besides traveling to Lithuania?
There is not, I'm just so embarrassed to say, getting a Wikipedia entry. We have the images, we have the material, we have the language.
So if your creative endeavor, listener, is that you feel drawn to helping these images get out into the world, there is a need within the Boise Peace Quilt Project for a Wikipedia page, maybe a little bit of tech help if that feels like your creative.
Yeah, that's so true. They can look at some images on Facebook. But interestingly, we have flown under the radar. You really can't find very much about us on the internet, even though we have been very, you know, publicly written about and gotten a lot of coverage over time. So,
yeah. So there is a need to bring it to the internet.
Yeah.
If anybody,
you can see some images on Facebook under Boise Peace Quilt Project.
Okay. Or in my mother's guest room. There's the print of one.
Come on over and visit.
Yeah. And so you and Marsha are every week at the Boise Farmers Market.
During season, which is April to December. December.
Yeah. So you can find them.
Come downtown.
Not in the food section, but over with the arts and crafts. Last time I was there, it was next to some really beautiful pottery and all kinds of
stuff. We're kind of all mixed up now.
Oh, you're all mixed up now. Things have changed. Yes. I haven't been in years. I will admit, I have not been in years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can find them in person.
We'd be glad to see you.
Yeah. Yeah. And online is memorysisters.com, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do recommend just taking a peek at her scarves, because if nothing else, I think that visually engaging with the goddesses and I don't know. Some of them have cowboy boots. They're just so incredible. Yeah. Anyway, thank they're you. There for you if you.
Thanks.
Anybody yeah. wants to check them out. And thank you, Heidi, for taking the time to talk to us about your experiences with creativity and community and building resilience.
Well, it's nice to be asked, and thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah, it's our pleasure.